Now, as the heat wave gripping the Mediterranean continues, some
more than 100 people, 120 people have died, and hundreds more are still missing.
Temperatures have been at or above 110 degrees for 27 days.
From intense and deadly storms ripping through the middle of the country, killing at least
more than 180 people have been killed due to record amounts of rain.
Right now, the temperature is about 15 degrees above the average temperature for
winter. Another 122,000 people have been displaced.
But scientists say the extreme weather is happening more often because of human-caused climate change.
But the ultimate driving factor is human-induced climate change that causes the weather patterns that we see today.
Welcome to Heat Beyond 1.5, your podcast exploring the pressing challenges of the climate crisis and the innovative solutions driving our response. We dive into how technology, entrepreneurship, and resilient strategies are helping us adapt to a rapidly changing world. Join us as we uncover the tools and ideas shaping our future in the face of climate uncertainty with your hosts, Nicholas Samios, Managing Partner at PT1, and David Vaudman, Managing Director at DWR Eco.
In today's episode, we want to look at a specific issue in climate adaptation, namely water. Water connects the major parts of the Earth climate system. Air, clouds, the ocean, lakes, vegetation, snowpacks, and glaciers. Climate change changes weather patterns, including, of course, rainfall patterns. Climate change affects the whole water cycle, where, when, and how much water is available. With the continuing global warming, extreme weather events such as droughts and heavy rainfalls and floods are expected to increase. These are the topics I want to talk today with my guest Ingrid Timpel. She is Deputy Executive Director and Senior Policy Lead of the Alliance for Global Water Adaptation. My name is David Vaudman.
The challenge.
Hello, Ingrid. How are you doing?
I'm great, David. Thank you so much for having me here today.
So before we start into the discussion, let me know and the audience quickly, what is ACWA doing? What is the Alliance for Global Water Adaptation's focus?
Great. Well, yeah. So as you mentioned, I work for an organization called AGWA, the Alliance for Global Water Adaptation. And we are a US-based NGO, but we work globally. We're a network of over 2,500 individuals that work at the intersection of climate change and water. So these are hydrologists, these are journalists, these are economists, lawyers, really running ecologists, et cetera. I work on the policy side. So the majority of my work is focused on taking solutions around climate resilient water management, which we'll talk about today, and bringing those to policymakers. I work primarily at the international level. So I work with the UNFCCC, with countries, with governments, kind of on that integration of water and climate change. So that's kind of my day-to-day work, really just kind of advocating for water resilient management.
Great. So you are such a subject matter expert here. Maybe you can help us to understand and explain how climate change is actually impacting the water system. So what are the most pressing water related challenges we are seeing today?
Sure. Yeah. You mentioned it a little bit in your introduction, and the word that the IPCC actually uses that we also use is that climate change is supercharging the water cycle. So if you going back to primary school, right, that diagram that we all studied of the water cycle, of where water falls on the land, it runs off into rivers or seeps into the underground to be taken up by plants and trees, or runs off into the ocean where it then evaporates and then condenses, and then we start the cycle all over again. Climate change, and so with every degree of global warming, we're looking at increased risk from droughts and floods, and then, of course, the associated societal damages that come with that. For example, warmer air can hold more moisture, and so this increases the chances of heavier downpours that contribute to the risk of flash floods, for example. But what I want to say about that, too, is, we kind of put these things in opposition, floods or droughts, and it's actually not either, it's both. It's extremes on both ends, and then the way that they interact with other hazards like wildfire, extreme heat, sea level rise. So if you look at areas like maybe Mexico City or Hunan province in China, which are facing these kind of long-term stressors of drought, flash floods there can be particularly devastating. Or if you give the example of Florida here in the United States, it's facing this long-term sea level rise, but that's being mixed with more intense and frequent hurricanes. So it's kind of the combination of the slow onset trends with rapid shocks, or sometimes it's called precipitation whiplash. And with that comes this idea of uncertainty about future water patterns, as well as the amount that we'll need to satisfy growing demand, water for energy, agriculture, industry, human consumption, et cetera. Our water systems are already so stretched. So climate change just adds this new element of uncertainty, if that makes sense.
So absolutely. Climate change affects where, when, and how much water is actually available. And as you indicated, and as I understood, is that water, too much water and too few water, so droughts, are actually happening and taking place at the same geographical area. So it's not just that we talk about different geographical, let's say, occurrences, but those both extremes can happen at the same area.
Exactly. And how does that then impact, you know, your ability to kind of manage these things? So water managers are just facing increasing pressures. There's increasing costs related to managing those things, et cetera, et cetera. So there's just a lot happening, basically, when you have this supercharged water cycle happening.
Yeah. So we talk about water scarcity, extreme rainfall and floodings, storms, obviously, hurricanes you mentioned also, but probably water quality. If you think about pollutions or waterborne diseases.
Exactly, exactly. So, in terms of when you have more water falling in a short period of time, you're reducing the ability for that to kind of infiltrate naturally into the system. So it's just running off quickly. And especially in cities and areas where you have a lot of what are called impervious surfaces or concrete, you know, things that can't infiltrate water. It's just picking up everything that's on there. And in agricultural systems, that's picking up chemicals or pesticides or these sorts of things. And then that's just pulling that into the water body. So pollution, like you mentioned, can become a major challenge.
Yeah. So as you mentioned, we probably see different challenges in different sectors, agriculture or in the urban development, urban environment. So who is the most vulnerable at the end of the day? Which sector? Which population?
Unfortunately, because the water systems touch all sectors and touch all systems, they're all pretty vulnerable. One that I especially want to mention that we haven't talked about yet that's uniquely vulnerable actually are ecosystems and biodiversity. Mm-hmm. And so ecosystems also need water to thrive and continue to exist. And so as we are increasing water scarcity in some areas, that's affecting important ecosystems like wetlands or peatlands. And these are actually ecosystems that are incredibly important in the climate conversation on the mitigation side, because wetlands and peatlands in particular store way more carbon than even trees or other land-based systems. And so when we're losing those systems, that's actually increasing climate change as well. So ecosystems, our biodiversity, are actually uniquely threatened as well. But as we mentioned, for agriculture, because agriculture is the single largest water user, right, of all the different systems, obviously, mm-hmm. it's quite vulnerable, whether that's changing crop suitability in areas, you know, if water is decreasing, or the need to use more water because it's hotter out, for example, or the productivity is being reduced. But then you also have to think about balancing trade-offs between other users like energy or industry. So one of the examples that we give a lot is Vietnam. So Vietnam is growing. It needs more energy. It's getting a lot of this energy from hydropower systems. Well, hydropower systems are also impacting, you know, if you're taking water for hydropower, that's also impacting things like fisheries and rice production, which are two of the largest, you know, crops produced in Vietnam. And so they're having to kind of manage these trade-offs more actively. And so that's some of the things that we think about on the agricultural side. On urban systems, really these kind of shocks and stressors are really testing and sometimes exceeding the limits of infrastructure. It's making infrastructure much more expensive to operate. Obviously, in floods and storms, we're destroying property. As we've already mentioned, increasing contamination of nearby water bodies. It's forcing more people into cities. In water-scarce areas, we're reducing our groundwater reserves. We're straining our energy systems, having to do more pumping. And then, of course, straining public budgets in many senses, you know, where they don't maybe have a lot of money allocated for these types of things. So there's a lot.
There's a lot, and also a very direct effect, right? If you talk about energy, as you mentioned, I mean, we will probably have less energy produced by hydropower, for example, if we have drought years. And agriculture, you also said, I mean, this at the end of the day, eventually means reduced food availability, increased prices, less quality, more water also increases the prices. But if we also think about simple things like transport and shipping here in over in Germany, for a certain time, the Rhine River, for example, had didn't have enough water to have the ships, going from A to B to transport coal, for the coal energy stations, which was good in that case because we actually don't want to burn more coal. But there's also you see that there's a lot of impact on that. So obviously, our civilization is vulnerable around that. We will see a lot of effects. And can you explain us what climate adaptation means in the context of water management? As we all know, we want to fight against climate change, so every single degree is necessary. We are avoiding of increased temperature, but eventually we need to talk about adaptation. So why is water management such an important aspect of climate adaptation?
Yeah, so I mean, I think we've been touching on it a little bit, and I'm excited to talk about this side because this is kind of more of the how can we adapt, how can we manage? Because what we've kind of set up here, these are a lot of challenges, right? And, you know, we want to also say, like, there is hope, like there are so many things that we can do. But as we've kind of laid out, you know, climate change is primarily felt through the hydrologic system. It's felt through water because so many of the increasing hazards that we face, these floods, drought, aridity, storms, sea level rise, they're all water related. But even impacts like extreme heat, which isn't maybe directly caused by changes to the water cycle, they impact water supplies in terms of greater demand for water and energy. So adapting to these so-called, we call them new normals, inherently means adapting how we manage our water resources. And so by investing in water resilience, and we can talk a little bit more about what we mean by that, we can help people, ecosystems, economies adapt. And in some cases, transform, because we're already so long on, you know, we're pretty far along on this journey at this stage. And we still need to fight for every degree. People are saying, oh, you know, we're going to blow right past 1.5, we're going to blow past 2. That's possible, right? But we still need to fight for all of that. At the same time, it's not an either or. It's not we can only do mitigation and then we do adaptation. We have to do them both at the same time because they're happening at the same time. And these water changes, as you mentioned on the Rhine, they're already happening, right? And they're already happening around the world. And so we have a bunch of solutions and a bunch of things that we can do to address these challenges.
Yeah, this is very interesting, but maybe to be more specific, what different strategies can government, municipalities, and probably international organizations or regional organizations as well use to adapt water management to a changing climate?
So first and foremost, the way that I like to think about it is that we need a transformation in the way that we think about water management. So if you give the example of infrastructure is generally built using what are called 100-year event models, which is basically saying that they rate the infrastructure based on weather events that are predicted to happen every 100 years. And that's primarily because our infrastructure is built in many cases to last about 100 years. Some last much longer, some last a little bit less, but that's generally how we kind of think about infrastructure. Well, when you have these 100 years events that are now happening every 50 years, or every 10 years or 5 years, those are no longer kind of good ratings for building infrastructure. So we need to kind of, again, transform how we think about how we build our infrastructure, because near-term previous water conditions can't really tell us what the future is going to look like. We have to look at a much longer historic record. So we now have new tools like paleohydrology and tree ring data, which can give us a better understanding about conditions under previous climate extremes. However, that also needs to be balanced by our current hydrologic reality, as I call it, which is informed by a lot more than climate. So we need to take in consideration current issues like land use change, population growth and movement, biodiversity loss, global supply chains. And so what that means is that we need to build in to manage this kind of growing uncertainty, we build in things like flexibility and also robustness. And so in areas where there is a lot of uncertainty, we build in flexibility in terms of the management and operations. So what could this look like, for example? It could be adjusting dam operations to account for more extremes on both ends. So having an additional spillway or flood retention area that can be used to store excess water in high flow times, for times when water levels are much lower. So that's an area kind of around like uncertainty, but where we do have higher confidence about kind of future, about the future, then we can build in robustness to improve the ability of our systems to withstand these greater extremes. So for example, in a coastal area where there's a high probability of like 30 centimeters of sea level rise over the next 20 years, we want to do a lot more coastal hardening. But the biggest takeaway here is that hydrology is fundamentally local. So we need to take local conditions into consideration first and foremost when developing our climate adaptation strategies. And frankly, this goes well beyond water. Adaptation more broadly, you'll hear this broadly, is very, very local. And it needs to kind of start at that level and then take a bottom-up approach from there.
So these are basically hard infrastructure solutions, right? I mean, you mentioned storage, proper waste management, flood control gates, probably dikes, etc. What about nature-based solutions?
Yes. So on this, on that side, this goes back to things like I was talking about, like wetlands or peatlands or mangroves. These are natural systems that are very, very good at storing, filtering, processing water, et cetera. And so it's utilizing these systems often in kind of a hybrid model that actually works really, really well. And they're also more flexible than, say, kind of hard infrastructure necessarily. And they can be moved, they can be adjusted kind of in an easier way. It's not easy. All of this is complicated. And so it's not just to say, throw a wetland over there, you know, a constructed wetland, and that's going to solve all your problems. It's not. And a lot of it, too, with natural systems, we've also learned in doing this for a while now that our existing natural systems are much better at climate adaptation than kind of the constructed new systems. And this goes for things like trees. Right. You know, you hear about all these tree planting campaigns and these sorts of things. And that's great. But also just a reminder for folks when they're talking about planting trees, those trees also need water, right? And so that goes to the trade-offs. We can plant 10 billion trees, that's fine. But for them to grow, for them to actually absorb the carbon, they're going to need water to do that. And so that's a trade-off. And those are things that we need to be managing as we move forward. So that's more on the policy and regulatory side. But in terms of kind of solutions related to infrastructure, whether it's natural infrastructure, whether it's hard infrastructure, there's a lot that's happening. AI, digital tools are coming into this as well. There's a lot that's being done around kind of complex forecasting and modeling that can take all of these different kind of components into account and do better flood risk mapping and these sorts of things. They can do predictive maintenance on infrastructure that can help deal with all these sorts of things. So there's definitely a role for technology. There's definitely a role for AI and all these sorts of things. But also, again, that technology, AI data centers require a ton of water as well.
Again, energy and water,
energy,
right?
Energy and water. Yes. So again, it's complex, and we need to think about all of, we need to fundamentally think about all of these things as a system, right? And
right.
how
as
do they
system,
all interact?
Yes, and I think we just need to face reality that actually nature is the best ally for us and the best technology and solution provider, as you mentioned. And maybe something to add, we probably also need to be much better in early warning systems so that we just have areas better warned and then adapt very on short notice as well. Now, we have talked a lot about, let's say, too much water. So what kind of technologies and adaptation technologies or strategies we need in areas of more drought, so areas where we have too little water?
Yes, yes, exactly. And this is something like water stress. This is a major issue in a lot of places. It certainly mm-hmm. is where I live in the Western United States. And so this is, again, an area where, you mentioned early warning systems. There's certainly a role for those. Thinking about water reuse, thinking about the diversification of water sources where possible. Thinking about new or alternative water storage. So these are things like the nature-based solutions that we mentioned. It's not just wetlands and peatlands. It can be fallow agricultural lands that can be utilized for water storage. There's a lot of innovation going on something called managed aquifer recharge or MAR, which is a new thing that they're working on where, this is happening in many places, but in California in particular, in the Western United States, where runoff from the mountains, which is snow melt is happening sooner due to climate change. And normally has just been kind of running off in really heavy flows, which goes right out into the ocean. But instead, they're trying to capture that in fallowed agricultural lands so that it mm-hmm. stores and recharges the aquifer in that way. So thinking differently about how we kind of store water. We already mentioned things
and maybe
like,
also use the wastewater desalination, etc.
Exactly.
Well.
Exactly. So yeah. there's a lot of water reuse things that we can do. The one thing that I do want to mention here is that a lot of times when we hear about water scarcity, we think a lot about water use efficiency and the optimization of water. And we actually want to move away from that because that is not a resilient solution. That actually makes the system more brittle. If there's no slack in the system, when things change, there's no ability to adjust. And so thinking about having highly optimized systems, and this goes for agriculture, and it also goes for urban systems as well. It's kind of this on the same side. We talk about in urban systems, we talk a lot about non-revenue water and decreasing water losses from the system. Those are important things to do, and we're not saying don't do those. But if there's no actual water in those pipes or pumps, like to begin with, then it doesn't really matter like how efficient they are. We need to think much more broadly, again, mm-hmm. kind of about systems. Right. And especially with water mm-hmm. scarcity, that's incredibly important.
Maybe just to summarize, you could try to explain us what are the biggest barriers, but also maybe opportunities that you see for water, better and improved water management, and what are the things which policymakers, or maybe also technology providers, investors can do to overcome these barriers? I know it's a very open and broad question now, but maybe yeah. it's possible to give us this one or two answers, which are really key.
Yeah. So again, it's this, the biggest challenge, right, is that this is happening very fast. And the systems that we have in place, whether it's hard infrastructure, whether it's policies and regulatory frameworks, they're all set in place already. And they're designed in a certain way. And they kind of have set us on this trajectory. And in many cases, we're kind of stuck in those trajectories. And so it's having the ability to kind of change our policies, change our regulatory frameworks, change our infrastructure, all these sorts of things, we have to kind of play catch up at this point. But we can do it, and it's happening in a lot of places, and there's a lot of innovation. So I don't want that barrier to be something that makes people think, well, it's just too difficult for us to change. We can do it. It is happening. It takes some time, but it's happening. And the biggest opportunity, again, I go back to this idea of the system, thinking of water as more than just a sector. It's not a sector. You know, it's really an enabler. And this is something we talk about all the time at Agua, is water is really an enabler of adaptation and resilience. Water is the medium of resilience. And so by investing in, whether it's technology, whether it's nature-based solutions, whether it's changing policy frameworks and doing more integrated management of water at a basin scale, there's so much that can be done, but it's really thinking about water as a system and an enabler of economic resilience, of development, et cetera, et cetera.
Ingrid Timbo, thank you so much for this very brief but very deep insight into this topic. I know there's so much more to investigate on. I think we can encourage everyone to look at your work of the Alliance for Global Water Adaptation. And let's work on solutions together. Thank you so much, Ingrid.
Thank you so much, David. It was a pleasure to be here.
The Fix.
So for our water episode, I have the pleasure to welcome Molundo Cicione, CEO and founder from Pydro. So you claim to make water networks smart. Can you just give us a brief primer what exactly you're doing? And also maybe how you came to that topic as a CEO, as a founder.
Sure. Thank you for having me, Nicolas. My name is Blundu, founder and CEO at Pydro. And basically, our mission is to accelerate the transition to sustainable water supply. And this is the reason we're developing our sensor-enabled services for drinking water networks. So basically, we have developed a self-powered sensor. So we harvest energy out of the water flow to power the sensor. And the sensor can measure things like, you know, flow, pressure, and temperature at the moment. And with this, we want to give utilities a real-time insight into their operation of the network. This is basically for tools like digital twins or AI-based leak detection tools.
Okay, so I think a lot of our listeners will not understand what currently the status quo is in water networks. So can you describe what is like the situation right now? And I assume it's not fully digitized, right?
That's true, yes. At the moment, utilities are facing all kinds of challenges, you know, starting from aging infrastructures, high energy prices, water losses. What most people don't know is that about 30% of the water that utilities source, that they treat and distribute, never reaches the customer.
Oh.
And at the same time, about 1.8 billion people are projected to be living in areas where there is absolute water scarcity. And also, you know, the list is goes on. There is a shortage of workforce. And also there is also a crisis, you know, about 70% of engineers are considering leaving the sector. Mm-hmm. So there is a lot of challenges that they're facing right now. And they have got a couple of sensors installed in their network, but they face challenges, you know, due to coverage. You know, there is a lot of challenges when it comes to powering the sensors. Most of them are battery powered. And that means that we have to replace batteries very frequently. You know, going back to the lack of workforce, this is a major challenge for them. And they can't send data in the frequency that is needed to feed into these new tools, you know, like the AI tools and digital twins. So basically what happens is that they get data maybe once or twice per day. Sometimes a bit more often than that. But if there is a pipe burst, they don't immediately get alerted, meaning the leak runs for a couple of hours and usually they get a call. the utilities get a call that water is coming out of the streets, and then they react. So it's a it's not a proactive approach. It is a reactive approach at the moment. And this is what we want to solve, this challenge of not enough insights, not enough data. And this is done through our solution that, you know, generates real-time data out of the infrastructure.
So you describe the status quo, yeah, as being pretty much a black box, if you want to say so. So a lot of basic data, it seems, is still needing. Can you describe a little bit, like, what's the history of water network design and why it wasn't implemented in the past?
Yes, sure. So basically, most of the pipes are pretty old, you know, 60 years, even 100 years. Some of them started by not, you know, like stainless steel or plastic pipes. It was wood. And these pipes were buried under the ground and more or less were forgotten. So this kind of legacy assets have been there without being upgraded over time with new technologies. This is the status quo in most utilities, and they're slowly starting to integrate new solutions to upgrade them to plastic pipes. And if we go back much further than that, you know, I come from Zambia, as already mentioned, where water is scarce. In some cases, you know, you have water trucks, and these water trucks bring water to compounds that have got like a water tank themselves. So it depends on where you are in the world, the way you get the water. And the most common part is that you have got very old pipes, very old infrastructure that haven't been updated or upgraded with new technologies.
Yeah. Okay, so it sounds like a very common sense thing to roll something like that out, right? Is there now also, besides the different drivers that you already touched upon, so leakage, increasing scarcity, skilled labor shortage, and so on and so forth, is there also like a regulatory pressure or incentive to do something like that in different markets?
Yes, there is. If you look at the European directive for water, there is a directive that implies that utilities have to start monitoring their networks, actually large users of water have to monitor their water use, and they have to report on their water efficiency. So basically, if they have got a lot of water leaks and pipers and so on, they have to report that, and they have to present as well a strategy to reduce that in the next few years. So this is one part. Then if we look at countries like Italy, they have got about 40% of water losses. You know, imagine that. And they also face droughts. So there is even this kind of climate resilience approach of the EU to support this kind of countries to digitize their network. So a lot of funding, you know, to adapt to this kind of challenges they're facing right now. But in general, there is more and more regulation that forces more or less the utilities to monitor their networks much more than they have been so far.
Okay, maybe taking a step back, can you elaborate a bit how you came up with the idea, kind of what was the founding story of the company? Like, what's your personal background on that?
So I come from Zambia, nice country, by the way. It's in the south of Africa. And there for us, you know, access to water was not always there. And it was not like 24/7 like it is here in Europe.
Yeah.
I came to Germany when I was 9 years old with my brother, and here it was a different story, you know, 24/7 clean water that you can drink out of the tap. And this inspired me, you know, it made me curious to understand where our water comes from, you know, from the source to our tap. And by learning about this journey, you know, of the water and that it takes, the journey, I basically learned about the challenges they're facing. You know, it's like the pipe bursts, the high energy that is needed to transport the water. And based on that, you know, my background is mechanical engineer. And I would say that I'm an engineer by training and entrepreneur by heart, actually, because my childhood hero was MacGyver. I don't know if you could.
Yes, absolutely. Love him.
So basically, I really love his resourcefulness, you know, trying to solve problems with as little as possible. And I wanted to become more like an inventor. And I thought being an engineer was the closest to it. But I learned that entrepreneurship is actually what is close to, you know, problem solving with limited resources, actually. So based on that, you know, my connection to the experience of how water has been transported and also my urge to develop something, I came up with a concept that was designed to harvest energy out of the water flow, you know, because I knew that water flow in pipes is hydropower that can be used for other things. And through these discussions with utilities, I also learned about the massive challenges they're facing with water losses. Mm-hmm. So that we decided very early on to focus on that as a problem, as a challenge we'd like to solve as a company. So during my studies in mechanical engineering, I came up with a concept and I presented that to different utilities, among them Hamburg Wasser. Mm-hmm. And since then, it was a story of refining the idea. You know, we got a scholarship from the Technical University of Hamburg. And then, since then, I've been developing the solution to what it is today, which is a product or an MVP that has been installed in different countries in Europe, you know, starting from Greece to Italy and also outside of Europe, Australia. We've got installations. We also ventured out to India. It didn't work out at the first. So, it has been quite an exciting journey, sparked by the curiosity of how water is transported worldwide.
Excellent, excellent. Was it simple for you to finance your company, or was it like a challenging thing because, I don't know, investors didn't understand the needs and the market? Or is there also maybe second part of the question, you see that there's now more attention coming to these kind of infrastructure meets climate resilience topics?
Absolutely, yes. Yeah. Well, it was not easy. I wish it would have been that easy to get funding for the company. We basically started with friends and families, then got the scholarship from the University of Hamburg, then got some grants, and then it took us about 2 to 3 years to get our first venture round, led by Genius Venture Capital, or the venture capital from MV, for example. And then we were also very fortunate enough, you know, during COVID to find our current other investors, GigaHertz Ventures, you know, with Andreas, Sven, Stefan, and Roger, because they have got the experience in industrial IoT, and they were great sparring partners that helped us, you know, form the product, but also shape our approach in terms of the solution needed for the customers. So to set up at the beginning, it was not easy to get funding because, like you said, you know, some utilities didn't understand the industry. There's this kind of understanding that the water industry is very slow and with long sales cycle and so on. This is has been the past. And I would say that the way the water utility was in the last 5 years is definitely not the way it is going to be in the next 5 to 10 years and so on, because there's just too much pressure, you know, too much pressure in terms of the need to adapt to climate change, the water scarcity that they have, and just immense amount of pipe bursts and water losses. Just this year, a couple of weeks ago in Berlin, we had a major pipe burst that left hundreds of thousands, I think, of Berliners without water. You know, the fire brigade had to be called and so on. It was a big challenge for them. So to adapt to this kind of challenges, to be resilient, is something that is becoming more and more important for utilities. And not only that, it's also that if you look at the water industry, at the infrastructure, you know, it's a critical infrastructure that is maybe prone to cyber attacks. So they have to basically make sure that this infrastructure is monitored continuously to understand what is happening and to react fast if something happens.
And do you now already see that, let's say, a broader audience, yeah, not just investors, but let's say broader public, understands the how important, yeah, upgrading water networks, making them smart is? Or is this still an area a lot of people don't understand? Because, for example, I think we had a lot of public discourse now on electricity networks, right? So pretty much every news show you watch it, you will hear something everybody knows, for example, yeah, that Germany is behind with the big power link from north to south and so on and so forth. But I hear little stories in mainstream news about water networks.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, water has been overlooked for quite a while, you know, and there's this kind of meme where you have got CO2. CO2 monitoring as the favorite child, and water monitoring not getting a lot of attention. But it's something that is going to come definitely, and it's coming slowly. I've been in the industry for the last 8 years, and I'm seeing it taking more attention in the public eye. So it is not only the droughts in summer. So what a lot of people don't know is that we also have got water scarcity in Germany. This is making the news every summer, more or less. Also, things like the pipers in Berlin made the news, and it is slowly coming. And I think that is the next big topic when it comes to adaptation tech or climate resilience. And I can say yes, it is definitely. And this podcast today actually is also one of the proofs that investors are becoming more and more interested in water. And also, we are seeing a lot of VCs looking into this topic. We're seeing a lot of M&A action in this topic. So I can say that it is slowly starting to get traction.
Right. Yeah. Okay. Great to hear. So thinking ahead now for the next couple of years, can you just quickly tell us, so what are your plans for the next, I don't know, let's say 3 years or so? So what do you need to do to scale this up?
So in the last years, we focused a lot on creating a great product. I think we have achieved that. You know, there's a lot of utilities that are interested in our solution, that are implementing our solution. Then for us, the next step is to sharpen our business case to get to mass production readiness, you know, designed to cost reduction activities, and basically just to get more traction in the market, to find the right partnerships. Just last year in December, we signed a contract with a distributor in Italy. And right now working on a contract also for Greece, and also working on a contract for Spain. So for us, the next step is to have these strategic partnerships that are very important for our go-to-market strategy. You know, we want to scale through these partnerships because they have got the existing customer relationships. They can take part in tenders, and we want to sell into those tenders that have already won and that are projects right now. So this is the plan for the next 3 years. We're also looking into the household metering market. This is a huge market, by the way. And also, we'd like to have water monitoring as another parameter that is very important and that has got regulations attached to it. So if you ask me about our vision, where I see Pydro in the next 3 to 5 years, then it is about us becoming one of the trusted, you know, providers of real-time water data for utilities. And for that, we want to become the leading sensor-enabled services provider for water monitoring.
Right, understood. If you look like left and right to your different peers, right, because I assume it's a close-knit network, yeah, of entrepreneurs that do, let's say, water tech, right? So you will know a lot of people that do let's say, similar things about kind of water networks, water consumption, water industry, if you want to say so. Is that a topic where you say a lot of entrepreneurs are currently looking into, or is this also maybe a bit of advice that you could give to young entrepreneurs, that this is potentially like an under-managed sector where there's still a lot of good ideas, a lot of good companies that can be built?
Yes. So basically what most people know, of course, is that hardware is hard.
Yeah.
And what also a lot of people might know maybe is that hardware in the water industry is hard squared. But there's a lot of new technologies that have been embraced by utilities, and we're seeing a lot of digital twin providers out there, you know, offering AI-based leak detection tools in the cloud. So I'm seeing a lot of entrepreneurs going into that market, and there are a couple of companies that have got great products in this market, but it's sort of becoming a bit of crowded, I would say. So to new entrepreneurs that want to get into the water industry, I would encourage them to find solutions that can augment or that can be a complement to this kind of cloud-based solutions. This is basically what we did. You know, we see ourselves as the enabler, you know, through this water-to-data approach that we have with our sensors. We want to enable cloud-based solutions to work more effectively. And in terms of hardware, there are a couple of companies out there that are great, that are focusing on water quality monitoring. And they're using new technologies that are AI-based. And I think these solutions are going to see more traction as well in the future. So with that said, there is also, of course, big companies that are improving their offering. And mostly battery-powered or grid-connected, and they can be in some cases partners, but also, of course, in some cases can be competitors. So it is important for a company to understand where they stand in this kind of landscape.
Right. So maybe kind of coming to the last question. So is there anything that you want to send as a message to, let's say, either your customer groups or decision makers in the water sector, or also regulators, policymakers, that they need to like step up in the next couple of years?
Sure, yes. So to investors, I would say invest in water. It's going to be the next big industry. Then to the customers, I'm seeing a lot of customers that are embracing new technologies, but also there are some people in the company of these customers that are reluctant to implementing new technologies. So we have to lower the barriers, you know, to get new technologies into the infrastructure. Understandable, of course, that they're a bit of risk averse at times, but it's important as well to encourage new talent because, you know, like I mentioned earlier, there's an exodus of engineers. Mm-hmm. You know, 70% are considering going to a different industry because there they see the growth they can have for their career. And it is important to embrace innovation, actually. And it doesn't mean that you have got an innovation department, because my learning as well has been that just because utilities have got an innovation department doesn't mean that they're innovators. No, depends on how much they're really using new technologies, how much they're embracing new technologies. So my ask to utilities would be to go past just implementing innovation departments and implementing innovation. Then, to other professionals, engineers especially, because I'm an engineer as well, I would encourage them to look past these buzzwords or these hype markets like AI and so on, or crypto, and really to focus on, I mean, those are also very important.
Sure.
But really to focus on what, you know, the industries that are in need of their talent, how they can contribute to those industries. So this can be a big opportunity for them to grow as professionals. And it is definitely needed. So this is basically for these three groups.
Excellent. Molino, that was really interesting. So I learned a lot about that sector that has such a high relevance already today and will even more so in the future. And I think also the last points you touched upon, that it's super important that everybody understands this is one of the critical infrastructures per definition we have, and it will just increase to be more relevant. So therefore, I absolutely hope that this sector will be considered from a lot of young talent and decision makers to be like super hot, super sexy. This is something I think, yeah, we all need to talk about much more in the future. So therefore, thanks a lot for sharing your story and good luck with your venture.
Thank you. Thank you, Niklas.
Key learnings.
Nico, how are you? New year?
All good on my end. Already had some very interesting discussions.
Very good. Let's straight dive into that, literally into the water. Because I've been meeting with Ingrid Timbo. She is executive director and senior policy lead of the Alliance for Global Water Adaptation. And she has a very, very interesting job. And I was talking with her about, in particular, how the water circles are affected by climate change and what can do about it.
So what are your main learnings?
Well, if I summarize them into maybe three different points, I would say that she was saying that climate change is intensifying extreme water cycle disruptions. So really threatening the ecosystems, agriculture and infrastructure. So meaning droughts and floods are becoming more frequent and intense, often occurring in very short successions. And water scarcity endangers agriculture, while floods damage cities and industrial infrastructure. And the natural water storage system like wetlands and forests play a crucial role in climate protection and biodiversity, but are increasingly being destroyed by climate change. So this is really number one. And number two is that water management must be rethought. So we need to be moving from rigid systems to more flexible, nature-based and technology-driven solutions. So what does it really mean?
And I think the discussion I had with Molundo, the founder from Pydro, goes exactly in that direction. And I learned a lot from that because basically he told me that water management currently, if you think about how utilities manage their water networks, is still on the technical level of 100 years ago, basically. So nothing smart, nothing sensor-based, nothing real-time, which is kind of outrageous because countries like Italy, for example, tend to lose 30% up to 40% of the fresh water they currently have in the system. And furthermore, he told me that the utilities also face a skilled labor shortage. So it's currently not cool for young engineers to work in water networks. And this is an obvious thing that needs to be changed because, come on, how crucial is that, right? So therefore, I'm extremely happy to see that there is a small but growing ecosystem of founders like Molundo that could be entrepreneurs in any interesting engineering field, yeah, but choose the water area because of its specific importance today, yeah, and even more so in the future.
Yeah, and this is exactly in line with what Ingrid has been saying. And very interesting, I thought, is that she's saying that down the road, we need to combine natural solutions, so such as wetlands or forests. We must integrate them with technical infrastructure. So really think both on the natural and also technical solution basis. And on the technical side, she was highlighting that, of course, digital technologies and also AI can help optimize water use. But that's a little bit of a rebound effect as well, that some of these technologies also need energy and also require water themselves. So this all needs to come into balance.
Absolutely. So I think we learned a lot with that episode. So very interested in hearing the next ones.
Yes, and maybe just one last point. She was my interview partner was highlighting is that everything is connected, right? So we have not just talked about water, but the water crisis is really closely linked to energy, industry, food security, and of course, overall economic stability. So only a holistic cross-sector strategy can really ensure a sustainable water supply. And of course, we need to have some regulations, some technology, entrepreneurships, investments, etc. in this field. So let's continue our journey. And I'm very excited to listen to our and talk to our new guests very soon.
Excellent. Talk to you soon. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Thank you for tuning in to Heat Beyond 1.5. We hope you'll join us again next time. If you enjoyed this episode, please rate, review, and share the podcast to help us spread the word. This podcast is produced by PT1 and DWR Eco. For more information, visit www.heat.bc.